Hello, everybody, and welcome to another installment of Innovation Crush. My name is Chris Denson. In case you didn't know, this is your first time tuning in. This show covers all things marketing, innovation, ideas, smart people in the marketplace, smart entrepreneurs, and the ball doesn't stop today with a fantastic guest and actually my personal innovation crush, the editor-in-chief of Fast Company. Say hello, Bob Safian.
How you doing today?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm getting over a bout of food poisoning. Do I sound like I was sick?
You're holding it down well, which I really appreciate.
I'm literally holding it down well. I guess for starters, can you kind of give me and the audience a little bit of 101 on who Bob Safian is?
Who I am?
Yes.
Oh, yes, I am. I'm the editor of Fast Company, which is, New York-based business media. Got a print magazine that reaches about 800,000 people a month, and we've got a digital site that reaches about 11 million a month, and we cover the business of technology, the business of change, creativity. You know, there's a lot of business media out there that we feel like is kind of slow sometimes and boring and doesn't appropriately represent the energy that most of us feel when we go to work, that business is a major vehicle for progress in our world, and we like to cover that and encourage that and try to make it easier for people to do the hard job of thinking up new things and engaging with new ideas, which all institutions fight against, even those that say they want to embrace this idea of innovation.
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned that. You know, I think when I look at a Fast Company, I see this like broad swath of like just really cool stuff and well put together from an editorial and curatorial standpoint. And then as many of these inspiring stories you hear, there's so many large, I won't even say large companies, but just organizations that still don't know how to adapt. So where do you find that like Fast Company plays a role in like informing versus inspiring?
I think the mission really is more about inspiring than informing. Obviously, we want to be informing. We think of ourselves as teachers, and we're trying to use, engaging stories and engaging pictures, engaging headlines, images, videos, and so on to try to get our students and our audience engaged in the topic. But the information is going to shift all the time, right? And I think the answers to the questions that will drive an innovation and an innovative enterprise, the answers are different every time. That's part of what makes it innovative, right? So by that definition, the opportunities and the task is really inspiring. It's inspiring people to take that leap and to dig in and figure out what the answer is, and even sometimes simply what the question is for them and for their enterprise, for their situation.
That's great. And I like to think that, there's multiple touch points of the Fast Company brand, right? Like, you think of most publications, you think of them as sort of one track where you guys have video content. You've obviously played the social media card very well. You've got a series of events you do every year. Can you just walk us through some of, a few like key assets and components and even some of the thinking behind like, how do we, we're going to add on this functionality this year and we're going to do this thing next year. Like what is some of the, the rules of engagement, if you will.
I wish those rules were real static. It would make it a lot easier for me. my background, you asked about me earlier on, like my background, I grew up as a print magazine person. I worked as a top editor at Time and at Money and at Fortune before I came to Fast Company. And so I love the print part of the experience, and I love constructing things in print and the lushness of that experience, the immersion that you get in it, and the necessity to edit down to a smaller universe of content. And I do think that there's a critical place in our world and in our media mix for what print offers. But I, you know, we also have to recognize that every one of our consumers and one of our potential target readers is going to consume content in a different way. And so we have to be platform agnostic about how we engage with our readers and where and the different ways that we distribute our content. So, you know, we have, as I said, a website that's robust, that we're reaching 11 million people a month. And we have that website sort of organized to be about innovation and about design and about technology and about world-changing ideas and creativity. And those are sort of the tranches that we build our content around. But we are also reaching, you know, more than a million people a month on Flipboard. We have a couple of million, you know, followers on social media, as you mentioned. And we have to take the perspective that if all you want to do is follow our Fast Company's tweet stream, and you never read an article, and we never sell an ad against you, and you never buy a product from us, but you're satisfied with that, that's got to be okay with us, right? And if you're someone who would rather engage with us in person, and we have live events that we do across the country, and if we have to make those experiences satisfying for you, and if that's all what you want, that's okay. And if all you want is to, you know, download our app and read us on your iPad or on your phone, that's okay too. You know, we have to be open to all of those things.
In that case, though, like, you know, then what becomes sort of like, I think most organizations, right, they're the whole idea behind their presence on all these platforms is like they want to convert somebody to a paying something, right? Is that, you know, or is that a metric of Fast Companies, or is that sort of you guys want brand presence and brand lift, brand affinity? Like, what is the, what's the difference? What's the payoff?
Is my owner listening in? If he's listening in, yes. It's all about converting that to a paying customer. Sales,
yes.
I think we try to take a long-term perspective about this, and we believe that if we're delivering a compelling experience to a consumer who is discerning and distinctive, then in the long run, we'll figure out how to extract value from that, but that the starting point isn't like, how do I maximize the value exchange? Because all that's going to do is make me try to push you as a user into a bucket that's most valuable for me, and I'm going to undercut the long-term value of our relationship, right? I'm building a relationship. I'm building a community. I'm hopefully providing a resource that you as a user have some passionate engagement with. And we believe that in the long run, we'll figure out the best ways to generate revenue against that. I mean, right now, the biggest driver of our revenue of our business is advertising revenue, as with most media businesses. And, you know, we generate about as much revenue from, you know, a million or 800,000 people in print as we do from 11 million people digitally. If you look at that per person revenue stream, I should be trying to drive as many people from digital back to print. And that would be great if I could have, you know, all 11 million of those people on the magazine and I could make a lot more money in print. But I just don't think that's realistic. And that's not the way that, you know, those consumers are satisfied with engaging with the content. So I have to adjust my models.
Right.
My expectations.
No, it's a great lesson learned, right, is this idea of like being adaptive to what the world is actually doing and what they're privy to. I mean, especially when you, like you said, you have all these different platforms that you're on and people engage in different ways, and what's meaningful to them and how to engage and interact is going to be different. You know, I think I literally just started reading the print version of Fast Company last year, right? So versus like, oh, cool, like I read a cool article, I share it out, you know, it's one of my kind of go-tos in the morning. But then I sit down and there's this long form story there. And I start to think about like how journalism has changed just, you know, in the, what, it's been 20 years that the Fast Company has been around, correct?
20 years this year, that's right.
Happy birthday. How does it feel to be 20 again, Bob?
Yeah, you know, I haven't been here all 20 right. years, so I'm very proud of this, like an uncle, you know, like an uncle at a child's birthday. It's great nice. To come of this age.
Well, you know, but if you think about this whole ecosystem that you're dealing with, you know, what's changed in the past 20 years about getting good content and information out there versus, and you've been obviously been in the publication business for a while, you know, what changes about the strategies behind staying relevant?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two ways to look at it. I think from a consumer's point of view, there's been a terrific flowering of content. There's more content of more kinds available in more ways than ever before. Many of them that you don't have to pay for, you pay very little for. It's a tremendous boon for consumers. Again, think of all the people who use Facebook or Twitter or Snapchat. Nobody pays for it. You know, like it's right. It's this free resource. It's tremendous, tremendous opportunity. From the point of view of content creators, what that does is it raises the bar, right? It forces us to have to do what we do at a higher level and to be clear about what is our story and what isn't our story, right? I came to Fast Company from Fortune magazine. And our offices here in New York, I'm down at the World Trade Center. I overlook the World Trade Center Memorial, and down the way through the window, I can see Wall Street. And you know, when I first got here, and I looked out, and I thought, you know, to what extent should Fast Company be covering, you know, the Wall Street universe the way I worked on Wall Street coverage when I was at Fortune, and you know, we eventually made the determination that that wasn't our story. You know, the Wall Street Journal is going to own that story. Fortune wants to own that story. Bloomberg wants to own that story. That's fine. Let them have that story. That's not where I'm going to be able to add value in a distinctive way. But covering the intersection of creativity and marketing, or covering the intersection between design and products and design and management. These are areas that weren't really being covered, and that there were a community and constituency of business people who were less excited about the valuing of business activity based simply on whether a stock price moved, right, you know, a dollar or a nickel today or yesterday, but were trying to build something of longer term value, both for their organization and societally and culturally. And that's the group that we're trying to talk to. And so that defines the kind of coverage that we're going to spend our time digging into, and the kinds of characters that we're going to decide to write about. You know, I mean, the writing stories about Wall Street are great fun, but the stories tend to be about the same thing. They're about greed. Right.
Right.
And there's great storytelling you can do about greed, but it's a different version of the same story kind of over and over again. When you get into areas of creative building of products, of companies, the motivations of the characters and the people involved become much more complicated and nuanced, and to us, more interesting, more fun. Now, they're not necessarily going to be fun for everybody, but so the Fast Company reader, hopefully, you know, they're fun. And that's what we want to try to bring forward. And we want to try to shine a light on the way we think the world is going to look, you know, down the road.
Right.
And to prepare our readers for that future.
Well, it's interesting when you mentioned your reader, right, your audience and who you're going after. And this is my assumption, so correct me if I'm wrong, but when I look at, you know, this audience of sort of early adapters, people who are interested in what's next, and they're most likely, you know, clicking around a lot on the internet. They're absorbing information all the time, you know, probably more so than, let's say, a Shape magazine, right? Where it's like your monthly subscription is just enough. You know, how do you balance, like, the keeping up with the speed of culture and the speed of consumption versus, you know, great in-depth, you know, down and dirty, long form storytelling?
I mean, you have to mix all of those things, right? It's creating content in a magazine or in a website. You know, it's like being a chef and putting a meal together, right? You may love to have a good steak. But if you have steak for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and you have it, you know, as appetizer and main course and dessert, it's not a satisfying meal, right? And after a while, you're going to get tired of it. And so we have to build a menu and present you with a menu that will engage you and, you know, get you salivating and get your taste buds flowing, you know, and provide enough variety so that you want to come back and, you know, visit our restaurant over and over again. Right now, you know, we all know the diner that has like a menu that has a million things on it. And, but if you go there, you know, you should only get the hamburger. Like,
right.
I guess what I like to tell my staff for the magazine is, you know, and for the website, what we are is we're like a chef who's going to go to the local grain market and find what's fresh and build a menu based on what's fresh, right? And we have to keep going out to the market and adjusting our menu based on the stories and the activities that are going on right now, right? And not recreate. I know you love that, you know, that seafood that we had last week, but that's not what's fresh this week. And so I can't present you the same thing again. I have to keep moving to the next thing.
Yeah, that's really interesting. You know, there's a lot of organizations that have like, and I feel like you are it, right? But there's organizations that have innovation units within their business, right? And their goal is to sort of move at the speed of culture, where, you know, your entire entity is moving at the speed of culture.
We're trying to. Listen, we don't get it right all the time. You know, we make plenty of mistakes, and we look around at ourselves sometimes and we say, like, how did we get that wrong? You know, no one's going to get this stuff right all the time, right?
Right.
But you got to try. You got to try. And it's fun. I mean, for us, it's fun. It's fun to be able to, you know, to engage and have people who are doing wild things come by and tell you about them, and you spend enough time talking to those kinds of people, and you start to get a sense for who's really special. And you know, sometimes you may pick the wrong horse, but it's usually special in some way.
Is there anything in particular that you feel like you got wrong? Like, was it like, oh, we wrote a 15-page spread on the return of Friendster, and then
We've done a lot of stories about, you know, we did a story about Apple in 2009, 2008 or nine, when the stock was very high. And we thought that optimism about the company was kind of euphoric. And we were right. And over the next year, you know, the company had a dip. But that was not a long-term perspective, right?
Right.
And you know, and they've come back and been even better. And I think it's something that informs the way we tried to learn from that. We have a cover story out now about Amazon and some of the issues and challenges that Jeff Bezos is facing and that the company is facing in trying to balance. You know, core businesses that they're building their growth on and sort of new innovations and things they're trying, whether that's the Fire Phone that they had to write off $170 million for, or some of their entertainment activities. They're sort of, how is that going to help the bottom line? And you could look at them and say, oh, they, you know, Jeff screwed up a lot of things and he's lost his way. And, you know, but in the end, we don't want to come away and give our reader the impression that we think Amazon is in trouble or about to go away. You know, it's a tremendously strong innovation culture, very distinctive. And you know, so it's sort of recognizing the missteps, the opportunities, the moment we're in right now, the meal we're creating right now, but not that inappropriate expectations about where the future is going to lie.
Right.
Right. Do we think Amazon's going to be around 20 years from now? Yeah, I'm pretty sure Amazon's going to be around 20 years from now. You know, there are a bunch of other entities that we look at and we talk about where we say, you know, are they going to be around 20 years from now? Like, is Airbnb going to be around 20 years from now? Like, maybe they are, maybe they're not. You know, we'll see. Is something that looks like Airbnb going to be around 20 years from now? Probably. Right.
Right.
You know, is Lexus going to be around 20 years from now? Probably. Is, you know, Tesla going to be around 20 years from now? Maybe yes, maybe no, right?
Right.
Which doesn't mean that Tesla isn't a more interesting story right now than Lexus is, right? But we have to frame all those things in a way that take our reader to an understanding about where we are right now in time and what the possibilities are for the future.
I would imagine journalism is fairly empowering, right? As a writer, as a storyteller. And when you're dealing with this, the Fast Company brand of topics and subject matters and people you want to cover and movements and things like that, you know, you have all these different journalistic voices and different things that are out there, constantly happening. So I'm curious, as just even from a managerial standpoint or just your perspective, when you work with a team, you know, how do you ensure, hey, Joe, you've got this freedom of voice on this piece versus unifying the voice of the, you know, the parent brand, you know, how do you right. instill that?
I mean, listen, one of the most powerful things about being a journalist is, you know, you can write whatever you want, right?
Right.
You know,
kind of.
You can go and you can interview someone. You can say, I think he was an idiot, whether he was an idiot or not. Right. There is a lot of power and discretion that the First Amendment gives us as journalists. And, you know, we have to be responsible about the way we execute that. I mean, in terms of the voice of the brand, really, across all of the media that we're doing, it is challenging, because if everything that we write sounds like me, you know, it's going to get predictable and boring, right?
Right.
And so we need to have the variety of voices and executions in our stories in the same way that we need a variety of topics and a variety of people that we're writing about. You know, the experience of engaging has to continue to feel fresh. If you feel like, you know, I'm reading a new version of a story that I've read before, you know, that's problematic, right? So on the other hand, there are some central things about the relationship we are trying to have with our reader that we try to connect with. I'll give you a specific example that we deal with when it comes to the covers of the print magazine. And on the cover of the print magazine, in the time that I've been here, we always have a photograph of a human being, character, a person. Right?
Right.
And there are times where my creative director and my team would say, well, we're doing a story about X or Y. It would be easier to illustrate this with type, or it'd be easier to illustrate this with, you know, with some object. And I remind them that we are always going to have a person on the cover, because we want the relationship that we have with our readers to be warm and friendly and connecting. Right. And there is a humanity that we want to integrate into our brand and our experience and our community. And that, you know, we do that by having people on the cover. We do it through a lot of other things and other choices we're making in the voice we use with our stories. But that's one of the elements that sort of humanity and warmth. You know, some coverage is at some places is colder. You know, we want to be warmer. We want to be like your partner, your, I don't know whether to say your friend, but someone you trust, someone you want to, you know, engage with in a passionate, you know, personal way.
That's great. I mean, it sounds like a big job, right? You know, to preserve all these different things, because it's at the end of the day, you're dealing with, you know, I would imagine a great percentage of the people you work with are entrepreneurial, right? Like it's yes. They're creators. They're not like accountants. I'm sure there's some there, but it's very much go out, do your own thing. But hey, I need to reel you in on this decision or this, you know, this thing, but I still want you to feel empowered to do what we brought you here to do. So when along those lines, when I think about, you know, just you as a leader within the organization, you know, what are some of your like personal brand promises, right? Where do you kind of plant your roots? You know, are there some truths or goals like you kind of keep close to the vest as a leader that you want to instill in your team? Just what's the sort of the Bob Safian brand of leadership?
I mean, my personal style is to try to be as open with my team as I can. And, you know, my door is always open and I always tell people, you know, they should always feel like they can come in. You know, just don't be upset if sometimes I say I can't talk right now. Right. Like that, you know, I always say, you want to come in and ask for a raise? Anytime anyone wants, they can always come in and ask for a raise. Just, you know, don't be upset if, you know, most of the time the answer is no. Right. I mean, that's the reality of the sort of relationship that I want people to have, to be having. I feel like we have to constantly be sharing ideas and trusting each other and being candid. You know, candor is the hardest thing to maintain in organizations where people are over time, whether it's hierarchy or relationships that build up over time. You know, people don't want to say things that are going to, you know, quote, hurt somebody's feelings or, you know, it's sort of trying to wash out the things that are personal from the things that are professional that we really need to get done. If someone has a story idea or a story execution that's not working, you know, their colleagues need to be able to be upfront and clear with them about that they don't think it's working and why it's not working and not have that get personal. It's really hard to do. It's really, really hard to do. And it's something that is a sort of constant, ongoing, you know, ongoing sort of cleaning out and monitoring that you have to do to try to, you know, scrape away that cartilage that builds up over time naturally, and to get people to trust and open up and focus on it's about the work. It's about the, you know, the reader at the end of the day. It's about how we're going to be continuing to advance what we think is a really important story for our readers to embrace, which is that they are the actors in creating the future that we all want to live in.
That's pretty awesome. Cause I, you know, I think about, you know, I do a similar function, but just with brands, right? So we're, you know, we're constantly thinking of what's new and how can we be entrepreneurial and bring new opportunities and, you know, do these really interesting things. And, you know, but the one, I don't know, I guess I'm thankful for this is the fact that I can always tie it back to brand principles, right? I think when it's an editorial platform, it's like, this is cool. This is my point of view. This is how I think this story should be told. Whereas, you know, if I'm doing something with, I don't know, let's call it craft. And I go, okay, I can, if I have to say no to someone, I can at least say craft doesn't like X and their corporate mandate is this, and they've already done Y, right? Like I can, my reasoning and the arsenal of like just rebuttal information that I can give is a little bit different. So that I love the fact that, you know, it's, you have the same problem, but slightly different because it's an open sort of creators platform from that standpoint.
Yeah. That's, you know, you know that you're, when we're writing about brands, you know, brands like Kraft, Airbnb, Tesla, Amazon, whatever, you know, they all have their own, I don't know, their own things that they're most anxious about. You know, they don't want to be exposed. They don't want to have their brand represented in a way that isn't, you know, directly according to that, that area. And so you get information through a certain kind of lens, and understanding what that lens is really useful to us in creating the story. But in writing the story, we need to break out of that. Right. And often for the companies, you know, being written about this way is eye opening for them, right? Because you get so close to your own brand definition that you don't see the limitations that it puts on you sometimes. Sure. And you don't see the, I don't know, we all fall into these traps. And we have the same things here. We fall into these traps ourselves where we say, wait, why are we doing this story? You know, why shouldn't we be doing that story? There's a big story that we have up on our site right now about the withdrawal of American troops and materials from Afghanistan. Okay. And you could look at that and you could say, what does that have to do with innovation? Right. And what does that have to do with Fast Company?
That's exactly what I did when I looked at the, no, I'm kidding. It was,
but at its core, it's a logistics challenge, right? It's a project about how you're going to get all this materials out of the United States or back to where it belongs. And how do you creatively do that? And what is the business challenge that's involved in that? And, you know, it's, if you open your mind to these things, you can see these questions and challenges all over our world. You just have to get your mind to the right place. And then you have to figure out the way to, okay, how do I tell that story so that if I'm someone who really what I'm obsessed with is learning more about Apple, why do I care about what's going on in Afghanistan? You know, our job is to draw those connections, because you may be able to learn more about Apple from looking at Afghanistan than you can learn from looking at Apple.
I think I may have told you this before, but you know, when we go out to partners or guests or things like that, like one of our sort of pitch lines is like, we're a cross between Fast Company and The Daily Show. So, you know, and so it's funny that you say these things, because, you know, in a lot of the conversations that we have, sometimes I'll bring in a guest that's totally off kilter. Like, you go, okay. And usually during the conversation and before the conversation, I'm thinking of like, how can I take some principles from this conversation and tie it back to my core demo, right? So, I mean, I've had, you know, I once had two co-hosts, a co-hosting couple on a show called Catch a Contractor. And it was, you know, their whole mission is, hey, a lot of contractors are taking unfair advantages of the people that they're serving and not doing the jobs that they're supposed to do. And as me and the host started to talk, he's just so passionate about excellence. And anything less than excellence is not, you know, it shouldn't be out there, right, to an extent. And so you start tying these principles back into what your core audience will know. And it does give them a different, at least I hope in my case, it gives them a different perspective on how to approach their next problem or their current problem.
Yeah, I mean, these are, you know, sometimes these are the stories that, you know, in the situations that are most memorable to us, because they shake us out of our, you know, our assumptions, right? Because they're getting us out of our normal, I don't know, competitive comparisons. I'm as you're talking, I was thinking of, you know, in early 2008, Fast Company put Barack Obama on the cover. And at the time, Obama was trailing Hillary in the primaries. And there were folks on our team who were like, you know, well, first of all, you're not a magazine about politics. You know, this guy's behind, you know, it could be embarrassing. Like, why are you doing this? Right. And we had a lot of discussions about it. And there were two things. One of the reasons we did it was because, you know, we had not had a black man on the cover of the magazine for too long. And you know, like, why should we not take this, you know, rising black leader and talk about him, right? And then the story was about what we called the brand of Obama at that point, which was, you know, whether he won the nomination or not, whether he became president or not, the rise of this character and the marketplace that he was tapping into, right? This was basically the rise of a new product that was being, whether it became, had number one market share or not, right? Whether he won and moved to the White House, the power of this brand indicated that this product was having great resonance in the U.S. marketplace. And what did that say about the evolving nature of the American consumer and the American society and the American marketplace, right? And it allowed us to talk about communities and changing both demographically, racially, and in terms of age. And you know, now fortunately he did win the nomination, he did win the White House. So it made us look really prescient, but you know, but that really wasn't the, you know, you right. can't count on that when you're doing a story like that. What you're really trying to do is use something that is topical and in the news at that moment to get your reader to look at some longer term reality, which is the way, you know, the consumers and the makeup of the American society is shifting. And that should change the way you think about your product, your organization, your leadership team, right? Your all of it, all of those pieces together.
I like how you one-upped my anecdote with the story about the president. So thanks a lot for that one. Okay, I have no other anecdotes now. You just shut them all down. No, that's I mean, it's a perfect example, right? And you know, when you, either you're talking about personal branding or building a business, it's like there's all these parallels that happen in life in different situations and circumstances. So as you grow this brand, right? I think you guys are considering doing a series of events in LA. You know, we know you've done the Innovation Uncensored in New York and San Francisco. You know, as you grow, like what, how do you filter? And I think we touched on this a little bit earlier, but how do you filter like the opportunities that come to the table that you go, okay, we are going to place a bet on this one versus the other 12 that are up on the whiteboard that you feel like are still really strong?
I mean, it's, you know, I wish I could say that I have, you know, this great proprietary algorithm that allows me to, figure out how we make these choices. You know, I mean, the truth is that we just guess most of the time. You know, you make the best choice you can at the time. I like to think about it that, again, the same way I think about cover sometimes, which is, you know, whether this cover sells on the newsstand or not, I want to be proud of it, even if it doesn't sell, right? And I think that's the way we think about our events too. You know, what is a marketplace or an opportunity or a topic that we feel like can elevate the discussion, can bring together a community that we haven't brought together, and you know, and if we don't make a ton of money at it, you know, whatever. Like, we should be proud of it either way, right? Now those are hard decisions to make because, you know, we do have to keep, you know, keep paying the rent and keep paying people salaries. And so I can't be, you know, I can't be completely dismissive of what the P&L and the bottom line is for these things. But, you know, we've focused in New York and San Francisco on a bunch of our events, in part because we have a very, you know, strong audience base there. Los Angeles, we have a strong and growing audience base there. And that's one of the reasons we're thinking about at that marketplace. We do events every year at South by Southwest, at Fast Company Grill that we set up there. We have, you know, thousands of people come through during South by Southwest Interactive. And that's a very robust community that overlaps well with Fast Company. You know, and so we look at a lot of these different events sometimes in different ways. Sometimes it's better to latch on to someone else's event, as we're doing at South by Southwest. Sometimes it's better to partner with someone at, you know, at a conference they're doing, whether that's, you know, Advertising Week in New York or in London or the Cannes Lions or something like that. And sometimes it's creating your own events. We're going to, this is, you brought up my birthday. This is our 20th anniversary, and we're going to have a big 20th anniversary innovation festival in November, or probably in New York. That's still being worked out between various municipalities that were trying to keep everybody happy but get everybody interested. But you know, we just feel like there's an opportunity right now to use the 20th anniversary as a tool to bring together a lot of the people who have been central to our coverage over the last few years, and the people who we think will have the most impact in the years to come, the few years that are coming up, and to try to drive a conversation at a higher level between all those people, and then to allow our readers and our users and attendees of this event to be able to participate in and add to.
That's great.
Yeah, it should be fun.
I was going to say, with all these sort of assets and efforts and things you're doing, you know, long form media with the print publication, plus the online platform, plus events, How does Fast Company go about working with brands and, you know, in an interesting way, you know, outside of a print ad or an advertorial,
right?
Or advertising, I hate to say, but
I'll say that there has historically been a relationship between editorial and advertising partners that is strained, right? You know, that editors don't always trust advertisers, and I think, you know, the way I look at native and custom content, historically what happens is, you know, an advertiser will come in and create some, will create some custom content, and then our editorial team will have to drive eyeballs and traffic to that content. And the editors don't want to do it. They don't want to send their readers, their users, to content that they are worried is subpar, right? Not on brand, is not up to speed. And that is something that the best solution to is to make sure that that native and custom content that you're creating for brands is high quality, really good content that that those users are going to feel like, that's really good. Wow, that's great. You know, we did a video series with Virgin America earlier this year on our site, and, you know, one of the heads of our digital team was looking at the videos and said, wow, those are really good. I would have done those as edit content. And they were kind of complaining that it should have been done as edit content. Right. And I sort of thought, well, that's good. Of course, we want it to be that good, right? We want to have the quality of the content and that experience be high, so that from our user's point of view, when they go to that, they have a good experience and they want to come back. And if they come back to the Virgin America site or they come back to Fast Company, like, I just want them to feel good about the investment of their time. Time is the commodity that we are all, you know, so strapped in. And if someone's going to choose to spend their time with us and with our content, we got to make that time feel like it's worthwhile, like they're glad that they did it, you know, like they want to come back. And if I'm pushing them to, you know, whether it's an ad unit or custom site or someone, you know, and they feel like, oh, how did I get stuck in this place? And I hate this stuff. You know, it's not good for anybody. And it's not good. It's not good for our advertising partners either. Right. All of that stuff should be at the highest level it can be. That's going to help everybody. I just don't feel like it needs to be adversarial.
What did little Bobby Safian want to be when he grew up? I mean, you're obviously very passionate about this, and I don't think, you know, most people grow up and say, I want to be editor of a magazine, right, when they're kids.
Yeah, you know, I didn't really want to grow up, Chris. I just wanted to stay a kid. Hey, you know,
you can do that any day of the week. Just, you know, follow me around.
I was not thinking I was going to be grown up. Who wants to be grown up? I want to be Peter Pan, right? That's what we all want. We want to stay kids all the time. I didn't really plan on being a journalist. I got out of college. I went to Brown University in Rhode Island, and I really didn't know what I wanted to do. And sort of journalism was the closest thing I could find at the time that seemed like school. You know, you work on something for a while, you'd write a paper, and then you go on to the next thing, and it just sort of seemed, you know, the closest thing I could find. And it's, you know, it's been a really fun adventure for me. I mean, I appreciate now in a way that I didn't maybe when I was younger, but how lucky I am to have a job where I get to call up and talk to people like you and, you know, people who are really smart, who are really good at what they do, who share their stories with me. And I get to feed off of all of that. And then, you know, skim the cream off and share it with other people. I mean, it's a great gift. It's a great gift to be able to have. And it is, you know, I'm very lucky to have something that I work on that, that I love to do. I think people are better at things when they, you know, are engaged in them and love to do them.
Well, you've definitely done a great job with it. As we start to close a little bit, I'm going to ask you a couple of questions. One, obviously, the show is called Innovation Crush, and I'm curious as to Bob Safian, the man who's seen it all, is currently crushing on that's out there in the marketplace. You know, what's something you've seen? Like, gosh. Oh my gosh, that's awesome.
Those are tough questions for me. I will say that the story, the big story that I am intrigued and obsessed with, I think, you know, Apple as a big story has been a really interesting story, you know, because of Steve Jobs, because of its rise, it becomes sort of emblematic of so many things. But the transitions that are underway there now with Tim Cook building his own team and bringing in new people, and how that company operates in the long run, you know, as the legacy, as Steve's presence fades and the legacy adjusts. I think that's a really, you know, I think that's a really interesting, really interesting story for us as journalists. And it's interesting because, you know, readers are intrigued with Apple. So it allows us to get into a lot of those kinds of topics and stories.
Well, you just touched on something that's pretty interesting, too. I think about, you know, the Tim Cook story, kind of this idea of stepping into big shoes, right? You got big shoes to fill. And I would imagine, like, you know, before you came on board at Fast Company, there was definitely some thinking and strategy that went into your personal approach to how to create success, right? Oh, the new guy's coming, right? How do you navigate the new guy's coming naysayers? What are some of the strategies and tactics you take to see success?
Yeah, I mean, I mostly have to not be afraid of getting fired. You know, you just got to do what you think is the right thing to do and not try to, you know, second guess and play by somebody else's rules. And I was the editor of another magazine at a certain point where the ownership wanted to take the magazine in a different way than I wanted to. And I tried to sort of accommodate them and, you know, it didn't work out well. It was destined not to work out well. You've got to do what you feel is the right thing to do. And if the people you're working with or you're working for don't appreciate that and don't want that, you know, I'm not saying that you can't learn from other folks, but you know, if you're really passionate about something and someone wants to take something a different way, then maybe it's not the right place for you.
Right.
You know, and I mean, I have people say to me all the time when they're at you know, at big companies, and they say, you know, I want to be a change agent here, but if I do that, you know, I'm going to get fired, or I'm worried I'm going to get fired. And of course, it's easy for me to say it. It's not my life, right?
Yeah, you're not snatching food off of other people's tables right now.
Yeah, no. Right. That's tough. But yeah. But what I tend to advise them is, you know, you should go and do what you think is the right thing. You should be that change maker inside that organization. And if you are that person, if the organization rejects you, if the organism can't take you there because, you know, if the organism rejects you because you're too much of a change agent, someone else will appreciate that.
Right.
You know, some other organization will appreciate that, and you will be better off for it when you're in that other place.
That's great advice. I think we just stumbled upon the title of the episode. Don't be afraid to get fired.
Absolutely. Every day the door is open is a good day.
That's great. Last but not least, complete this phrase for me. Innovation to me is?
Changing. Always changing. Innovation is agile, and you know, it just can't really be defined. That's what I love about it. You know, it's in the eye of the beholder.
I love it. I love it. Well, thank you for joining us. This is awesome. I couldn't have appreciated your time more.
Well, thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me. It was fun. Fun to talk with you as always.
Yeah, always. And then how can people find you or get in touch with you or any kind of shameless plugs you want to throw out there? Feel free.
Oh, you know, we're on newsstands everywhere. You come to fastcompany.com and my Twitter handle is @rsafian. So you can find me on Twitter that way too.
All right. Well, thank you again, everyone. This has been another installment of Innovation Crush, and we will talk to you next time.
If you like listening to comedy, try watching it on the internet. The folks behind the Sideshow Network have launched a new YouTube channel called Wait For It. It's got interviews with comedians like Reggie Watts, Todd Glass, Liza Schlesinger. I've been friends with her for 10 years. One of the funniest people out there, and I still have a hard time with the last name, Liza. Our very own Owen Benjamin, that's me, takes you on a musical journey down internet rabbit holes and much more. You don't have to wait any longer. Just go to youtube.com/waitforitcomedy. There's no need to wait for it anymore because it's here and it's funny. And I love you.